I'm not sure if I'm starting a tradition or not this morning, but Kathy Fletcher, a member of our worship associates team, and I are going to try a little exercise called share a sermon. When it comes to some of the sermon topics I choose, I'm aware that there are a variety of opinions and perspectives on them. In addition to my basically religious humanist take on the matter, a variety of opinions on religious matters is not exactly an unusual phenomenon in a Unitarian Universalist congregation. So when I ask for some feedback from the worship associates about how I might approach my own angle on the subject of prayer, we eventually came to the idea of someone, as I'm going to talk in a more humanistic kind of a vein, well, maybe we should have someone speak in a more theistic angle on it. That's why Kathy is leading off the sermon today before I do my own launching into it. So Kathy, it is yours.
Preparing a 3 to 5 minute speech on it that you will deliver from right here. So we're going to talk about prayer. One of the wonderful blessings of my being part of this church has been my friendship with Roy Goodman. Roy and I have been members of the same covenant group for the past 4 or 5 years, and we meet monthly to check in and have conversations about things of spiritual and meaningful nature. Roy is an intelligent, kind, thoughtful person. He's also an atheist. Remember about a month ago, I sang like a funny duet with Gil Bray about you are theist, I am humanist? The lyrics of that song were not too far away from conversations that I had with Roy Goodman, and I played a theist. So when the subject of prayer came up, questions for the theist started flying. So do you pray? Yes, I do. Do you pray to a Lord? Someone with power over you, someone who's out there, who's going to be influenced by prayers? No, I don't think so. Maybe sometimes. Then why do I do it? So after much consideration, here are some thoughts about how, and more importantly, why I pray. I've said it from here before, I'm pretty sure that I believe in God. Not the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost that I grew up with, but something mysterious, something that's beyond us, yet part of us, something that somehow connects us, something that I feel like if I could only shine the right light on it, or tune it into the right frequency, or slow down time, or something would show up like a giant something, and a big aha would come, and I would see the simplicity of the pattern that connects all of us. Got it? And I do call that thing God, whatever that is. So I pray. I pray to remind myself of those connections that I think are out there and in here and all around us. So I pray before meals. My family thinks this is odd, but I pray before meals. Thank you, God. I'm grateful for this food and for the many blessings in my life. And what happens? I slow down. I take the time to eat slowly. I take the time to listen to the folks I'm eating with. And maybe I have a little bit more patience. A six-year-old spills his milk all over the table. I pray before I read the words of reflection, which I do sometimes, in a church service. I think, you know, I pray, God, let these words not be about me, but about the connection between all of us. I pray before I cook one of those big meals at the auction, every spring. Even Roy Goodman helps, and he says, prayers with me. I say, God, let this work be a service to the church. Let me give back some of the living energy and loving energy I feel here. Really, I guess I pray to focus my own mind, to remind myself of the good things all around me, and to remind myself to keep my actions of love and kindness. So I have friends who have a daughter with brain tumor. This is gut-wrenchingly terrifying to me. So I pray about it. Is there a part of me that would really like to pray, dear God, please just take away Andrea LaRue's brain tumor? Absolutely there is. Unfortunately, I don't believe in that God. So my prayers are more like, God, please help me recognize the best way to be friends with Lori and Harry right now. Please help me find the right things to say to them. Please help me recognize the moment when it shows up. Do I think these prayers are going to help? I hope so. yogis at the Kapalo Yoga Center, where I love to go on spiritual retreat, greet each other with bowed heads and folded hands, and they say Jai Bhagwan, which they translate as, I honor the divine being within all of you. So I offer these words today on prayer in that spirit, not as proselytizing, but to honor your own journeys. Jai Bhagwan. I can't say anything from here without crying.
Well, thanks so much. Thanks so much, Patty. It's really wonderful. Thank you for that. 1 week ago, this past Friday evening, I served as host to a prayer meeting. It was held down in our chapel. It was mostly attended by members of the local Baha'i community here in Nashua, and a few non-Baha'is would also come to offer support. The Baha'i faith very quickly is a liberal and rather universalistically oriented offshoot of Islam. It is roughly analogous to Unitarianism and Universalism being liberal, universalistically oriented offshoots of Protestant Christianity. This faith originated in Persia, which is now Iran, in the mid-19th century, and it emphasizes the spiritual unity of all humankind. The gathering held here was one that was being done in concert, was one being done in concert with other Baha'i communities in this nation and around the world were also holding to show their support and pray for the well-being of 8 Baha'is who are now imprisoned in Iran and awaiting trial on various trumped-up treason charges, including collaboration with Israel. It's essentially a form of religious persecution by the Iranian government, which, to put it mildly, has been less than friendly to the Iranian Baha'is since the onset of Islamic rule in that country following the fall of the Shah in 1979. I've gotten to know some of the members of the local Baha'i faith community here through my interfaith activities. I was very glad to host their meeting, and I was delighted we were able to provide them the space that they wanted on that night. And in certain ways, their meeting reminded me of an evening last July when a number of us came together here in this room in the wake of the shootings at the Knoxville Unitarian Universalist Church in which a gunman took the lives of 2 congregants and wounded several others when he opened fire on a Sunday service. The gunman had specifically targeted Unitarian Universalists due to our liberal stance on any number of social issues. Just give you a very quick follow-up on that incident. It was a few weeks ago. The gunman, Jim Atkinson, pled guilty to first-degree murder charges without going to trial. He's been sentenced to life in prison without parole. Well, while the content of the Baha'i prayers down in the chapel were markedly different from the sentiments that were expressed and shared in that service we held here back last July, the larger spiritual atmosphere, I guess you could call it, was quite similar in each gathering. In both cases, the adherents of a particular faith communion were called together in locales all around the country and world, all around the country and world to show support for certain of their members who had fallen prey to violence or who were being persecuted due to their religious affiliation. In both cases, that is to say, it was about family. Family in each instance of those who share and identify with a particular faith tradition. In both cases, it was about the members of a spiritual family, if you will, who were coming together because they needed to express their support and their love and their care and their concern for those in their family who were suffering, who were hurt, or who were in danger. And that's what the prayers and the meditations in both of those places were really all about, for all of their differences in language. And both of these gatherings serve to reinforce my belief that prayer has much more of a horizontal dimension to it than it does a vertical. Now, what exactly did I just say? Well, try this. By horizontal dimension, I mean that prayer is a way for a group of individuals to be in deep contact with one another, or a way for an individual to be in deep contact with him or herself. It is a way of harnessing and drawing upon your personal resources. Your personal resources of mind and spirit at those times when you need them the most. In a similar way, horizontal prayer is a means by which a group of persons, be they Unitarian Universalists, be they Baha'is, be they any other gathering of concerned people, it's a way that they can share their love and their compassion. It's a way they can direct the energies of their collective human spirit to someone or something that is of great importance and concern to them. I realize what I'm saying is really a more sort of abstract way of saying what Kathy offered to us in a much more personal way. But I think she and I are very much on the same page on that score. But what about that vertical dimension, to stay with my imagery here? What about that vertical dimension of prayer? The part that is addressed in traditional terms to God. Well, it looks like Kathy and I are also in agreement that we don't pray to a supernatural supreme being who can manipulate the workings of the natural world to our liking. I could tell you, if I could do that, all that snow and ice wouldn't be out there. And whatever storm it is we're supposed to be getting sometime late tonight would go out to sea instead of, you know, bothering us. But that's not the way prayer works in either one of our minds. I appreciate what Kathy says at the end of her presentation about prayer being addressing the divine being in each one of us. This echoes one of our Unitarian spiritual ancestors, Ralph Waldo Emerson. He had pretty much the same idea when he wrote that we all carry within us what he called the spark of the divine. So I would say, among other things, prayer is finding that spark, that divine spark within you, and being kindled by it, being nurtured by it, being motivated by it. Okay, let's take it a step further. Whatever set of beliefs or non-beliefs we may have come to in our minds, up here in our heads, there are still times, in ways we can scarcely avoid, when we find ourselves reaching beyond ourselves, possibly looking to the cosmos, for some greater levels of meaning, for some greater levels of comfort and assurance and love. And to work this angle, I'm going to try to work this angle a little bit about when we're sort of driven to reach beyond ourselves. I'm going to work this angle by going, ironic as it may sound, to my favorite atheist, who's Albert Camus. Well, actually, it's a toss-up, depending on which sermon I'm doing, whether my favorite atheist is Albert Camus or Kurt Vonnegut. I like them both a lot. But it's Camus that's going to get his due this morning. I first read Albert Camus' novel, The Stranger, when I was in a freshman English class. And it was a few lines in the closing paragraphs of that book that challenged my 18-year-old mind then, even as they still challenge my 63-year-old mind and spirit today. The central character in this book, and from whom the perspective of the novel is being written in his first person, is a Frenchman named Mirceau, who lives in Algeria, which is where Camus also grew up. And Mirceau is telling his story from a prison cell where he is awaiting his execution for a murder that he more or less stumbled into committing. And as he gets to the end of his story and knows his time is short, and down the last few paragraphs of the book, he says this as he looks out. He's got a little window in his prison cell there, and he can look out. This is what he says. Gazing up at the dark sky, spangled with its stars and signs, for the first time, the first, I laid my heart open to the benign indifference of the universe. When I was a college freshman, I was still very much in my conservative Baptist Southern West Virginia mode at that time. I was far from ready to accept what Camus, through his fictional character, is saying, namely, that we are time-bound creatures living time-bound lives in a universe that can only regard us with what he calls benign indifference. Play with that phrase for just a moment. Because on a strictly literal level, benign indifference is kind of an oxymoron. Since you cannot really show kindness and goodwill and good nature, which is what benign means, you can't show that towards a human being and still be indifferent to them at the same time. But I still like the way Camus puts those two words together, because he does it in a way that actually works. He is saying that the universe, or the cosmos in which we live and move and have our being, doesn't wish us any harm. It has no evil intentions towards us. It's just not aware and doesn't have a lot of care that we're here. And as my personal explorations and as my journey of meaning unfolded in the years since I first encountered this passage, I eventually decided, on this score anyway, Camus was right. He was right for me, in any case. But that wasn't where I stopped with it, because I also came to see that Camus' indifferent universe or cosmos is really a beginning point more than it is an end when it comes to any kind of spiritual searching and discovery, any kind of pursuit of meaning. So here's where I go from Camus' indifferent universe. Contained within this universe, which may ultimately be indifferent to our existence, there's something called life. And the individual lives we're given to live over a certain stretch of time are part of a larger flow, part of a larger process of life itself. And within that larger life, there's awe, and there's mystery, and there's wonder. There's the miracle of birth and growth, along with the presence, if not the pain, of death. There are connections, both within us and beyond us, that give our lives joy and fulfillment, deep peace at times. And there's also loneliness and despair, things that bring us face to face with our finitude. There are times when our lives are full of meaning, hope, and purpose. And there's other times when we find ourselves confronting meaninglessness. And as we live out our lives within this larger ongoing flow of life, we may well find ourselves, in the words of my now retired colleague in the UU ministry, the Reverend Gordon McKeeman, addressing a mystery. And that's another way in which the idea and the practice of prayer works for me, as addressing a mystery. For in addition to Emerson's divine spark within, another way of understanding God that works for me is that of ultimate mystery. But then, can you really pray to an ultimate mystery? Well, yeah. But in order to do so, you have to move past the idea of traditional prayer as words being addressed to a supreme being and expecting some kind of a specific result. If you can get past that, you can, as I think it is, pray to an ultimate mystery. For we can seek ways both in quiet contemplation and in meditation and in active engagement of finding and feeling our connection with the larger life that does enfold us all, and that does sustain us, and that does link us to other people who love and care about us, whatever comes our way. The words we generally use to close our period of meditation nearly every Sunday morning, which you heard today, I hope, are more than just a signal to end our silence. I take them quite seriously, and joyfully, and hopefully. The mystery is that we are connected, even when we feel apart. Let us rejoice in the common life that makes of the many one. So I think setting aside times for contemplation, for meditation, for personal renewal, I think it's important. For these are the times when we need to cultivate an awareness of how your one finite life is connected to the life that's all around us and within each one of us. Beyond all of that, I think prayer is more of an attitude that one seeks to live by than it is sentiments addressed to a deity. A prayerful life, and I mean that literal sense, prayerful, F-U-L-L, a prayerful life is one that is lived with a continuing awareness of how we are related to our larger human community and to this planet Earth, which sustains all the life that we know. Such an awareness and an attitude can motivate us in a lot of ways. It can motivate us to find ways to do justice and love and mercy, as the prophet, Hebrew prophet Micah put it. It can cause us to lift up our eyes to the hills and find some sustenance and nurture there, as the psalmist put it. It can cause us to consider the lilies of the field, how they grow, as the prophet Jesus put it. A prayerful life, that is to say, is a life lived in an ongoing way that seeks to always cultivate a reverence for life. Well, I'm going to go back to Reverend Keeman, whom I mentioned earlier, to use a poem of his to close. The poem, in fact, is called Addressing a Mystery. I guess you could also title it How to Pray If You're Not a Traditional Theist, but Addressing a Mystery is a little better ring to it. Button McKeon. How to Address a Mystery. Reverently. Let us go with a sense of awe and wonder, a feeling of approaching a powerful holy whose miracles are present in every place and moment. Hopefully, out of the need for wholeness in our lives, the reconciliation of mind and heart. Quietly, for no words can explain the inarticulate or summon the presence that is always present, even in our absence. Simply be in the intimate presence of mystery, unashamed, unadorned, unafraid. To live in such manner is to live a prayerful life. Well, I thank Kathy for her contribution to this sermon. I could write a little shorter one than I usually do on a given Sunday. And I'm going to ask each of you to join with Kathy and I in bringing these words to a close by singing together our closing hymn, It's Blessed Spirit of My Life, number 86. Thank you.